the headlines this hour. The United States threatens Nicaragua with sanctions after incumbent Daniel Ortega wins the Central American country's race for president. The Yemeni army's air defenses shoot down a spy drone over the Flashpoint province of Ma'arib. And thousands in New Zealand turning out to show their disapproval of the government's lockdowns and COVID vaccine mandates. Thanks for joining us. Incumbent Daniel Ortega winning Nicaragua's presidential election and clinching his fourth consecutive term in office. The Electoral Council says almost all ballots have been counted, and Ortega has won with over 76% of the votes. Ortega is hailing the results as a victory against terrorism and the enemies of Nicaragua. Washington and the European Union have rejected the results. The U.S. Secretary of State says that his country is ready to use a range of tools, including sanctions and visa restrictions, against what he's calling the Nicaraguan government's undemocratic acts. President Joe Biden has also accused Ortega of orchestrating, quote, a pantomime election that was neither free nor fair. Russia, on the other hand, is supporting Nicaragua and says that the Western reactions are unacceptable. You earlier asked our correspondent in Managua, Ahmed Caballo, to weigh in on the results of the election in Nicaragua. He believes the re-election of President Ortega is the people's choice and that the U.S. is in no position to cast doubt on the country's electoral process.
There were people, long queues yesterday, waiting to vote. Today, there were Sandinista supporters celebrating. Yesterday, when we came back from the National Assembly at 4 a.m. in the morning, there were street parties with people with Sandinista flags celebrating. So it's very clear, and I've been here for 7 days now, that the president and the Sandinista movement is very popular. And the United States doesn't get to decide what is and isn't a fair election. There's many controversies over the recent election between Joe Biden and President Donald and the former President Donald Trump. Yet Nicaragua doesn't call the election result illegitimate and pantomime elections. So what gives the United States the right to do the same? It is not the world police as it tries to present itself. And the other European allies, the European Union, the United Kingdom, these are all interested in breaking up what is considered the new non-aligned movement, which involves Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Russia, China, countries that do not want to be dictated to by Washington.
A setback for the U.S. president. A poll finds that Americans are increasingly dissatisfied with the way that Joe Biden is handling his job. The CNN poll puts Biden's overall approval rating at 48%. 38% of those surveyed said they strongly disapprove of his performance. The poll also suggests that 58% of Americans believe that Biden has not been paying attention to the country's most pressing issues, including the economy. An analysis of the data indicates the dip in Biden's approval has been due to disappointment among his original supporters. That casts doubt on the Democrats' ability to maintain their edge over their Republican rivals in the 2022 midterm elections. Just over 1,000 adults participated in the poll conducted between November 1st and 4th. The reported margin of error was 4 percentage points. We've talked to political commentator Ian Williams to get his thoughts on Biden's declining approval rating. He says that Biden fails to see the overall agenda, and that spurs a Republican backlash against him.
Joe Biden is not brilliant at messaging. He doesn't emphasize it. He's actually performed better than many of us expected. He has just won a significant quasi-victory to get a stimulus bill through. He has managed to get most of the country vaccinated. But what he doesn't do is to seize the agenda. And that's where the Republicans are in. He has wrestled with the Supreme Court and the abortion issue, which is not completely a vote winner amongst women, but it means that he has to waste time on that when the big issue is getting people healthy, getting people employed, and making sure that people stay solvent. And he's been trying to do that, but he can't do it in a very spectacular way. He can't pull a white rabbit out of his electoral hat, even though he's tried. And he keeps letting the Trumpers dominate the agenda and his own party. I mean, the point is that nobody sees any difference now between Trump and the Republican Party. They come as a package, whereas Biden has to carry all of the sins of the Democratic Party. So he has two complete right-wing corporate shills holding the country to ransom. That's the Democratic Party. That's part of his responsibility as the Democratic president. People see that as a reflection of his failure, because he hasn't taken them out and politically at least shot them. He hasn't been able to discipline them, which makes him look weak.
A large caravan of migrants coming from Central America is now heading to the U.S. border rather than the originally planned Mexico City. The change in plans comes after reports of clashes with Mexican police forces and detentions in the past days. The caravan leaders say that thousands of migrants are set to join the group later and set out for the border. The group, once as large as 4,000, began its journey 2 weeks ago. However, it has dwindled after walking for hundreds of kilometers through heat and clashes with migration officers. Washington is pressuring Mexico to contain them before they reach the U.S. Migration agents are increasingly using tough tactics to stem the influx. Another Palestinian prisoner is facing a critical health condition after a prolonged hunger strike, an objection to the Israeli jail system. Palestinian media say that Kayet Fasfus has been refusing to eat for 118 days now. He's among six inmates on lengthy and life-threatening hunger strikes against their indefinite detention. Hundreds of Palestinian administrative detainees have stopped eating in protest. They also complain about hostile jail conditions, including harassment and torture. The UN has expressed grave concern about the lives of the Palestinian hunger strikers. Administrative detention is illegal under international law, but Israel uses it to lock up Palestinians without charge or trial indefinitely. Five European countries are questioning Israel's move to place six Palestinian human rights groups on the so-called terrorist list after Security Council meeting on Monday. The Security Council remained silent on Tel Aviv's decision, but France, Estonia, Ireland, Norway, and Albania say that they will scrutinize the Israeli claims. Last month, Israel designated six Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist organizations. The move has drawn a lot of criticism from the UN and human rights watchdogs. The five European countries are also calling on Tel Aviv to end its settlement activities in the West Bank and East Outlets. They say Israeli settlements are illegal under a Security Council resolution. New developments out of the southern province of Marib in Yemen were learning that a short while ago the Yemeni air defenses shot down an unmanned spy drone in the airspace of Juba district. Marib has for some time been a flashpoint of conflict between the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters on the one side and the mercenary forces supported by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. Yemeni forces have been inching closer to fully liberating the province. They are already controlling the Juba district. That is the last area that was held by militias in the south of the strategic city of Marib. Let's find out more about this from Abdul Latif Al-Washali, a correspondent who joins us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. So you have a drone that was shot down, if you can tell us about that, and also where the situation stands when it comes to Marib, and how much territory the government actually has is in its control.
Thank you so much. The Yemeni army managed to shoot down another Scan Eagle, which was hovering over Al-Juba district, which was liberated recently by Yemen's armed forces after fierce clashes for weeks, actually, with the Saudi-backed forces. The U.S.-made drone was hovering over Al-Juba district to carry out some hostility activities against the Yemeni people, against the people of Al-Juba district, the people of Marib. This is the fifth drone of a Scan Eagle, actually, type to be shot down during this year, and it was shot down by a weapon that was not revealed by the Yemeni army. Yet the spokesman of the Yemeni army General Brigadier Hassari said this kind of weapons will be revealed soon, inshallah, to show the world the capabilities of the Yemeni army, how the Yemeni army managed to improve and develop its own armed air defense to defend the airspace of the Yemeni land, the Yemeni soil, to defend the sovereignty of the country. Military sources say that this kind of drones is being operated and run by U.S. experts, as the United States is attempting to maintain the reputation of the U.S.-made weapons, and to keep the reputation of the U.S.-made weapons, especially after they have got really damaged after the Saudi-led war have begun against the Yemeni people.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Abdul Latif al-Washali there from Sana'a. Large-scale maneuvers by the Iranian army draw to a close with a final parade by a fleet of vessels and aircraft. The parade involved destroyers, frigates, warships, and submarines. A group of warplanes, reconnaissance aircraft, and drones were also flown to support the naval vessels. The spokesman for the drills says that the exercises featured a whole range of operations carried out in an area of over 1 million square kilometers. Rear Admiral Mahmoud Mousavi says the maneuvers were meant to boost the Army's combat capability to defend Iran's territorial integrity and reinforce its presence in international waters and strategic areas. Meanwhile, new developments have emerged from the drills, saying at some point, the Iranian air defense units intercepted American drones entering the country's air defense ID zone. The drones stopped getting closer to the Iranian borders and flew away after they were warned. The New Zealand government's coronavirus restrictions, including compulsory vaccinations, have angered many people there. Hours ago, the capital, Wellington, became the scene of a big protest against those policies. Thousands of people marched on the parliament. They held signs and chanted slogans demanding a return to what they called the pre-pandemic freedoms. Unprecedented security measures were in place, and both entrances to the building were closed off. The government has changed its strategy from lockdowns to mandatory vaccination for all. New Zealand has largely fended off the pandemic with under 8,000 total cases and only 32 deaths. But the new Delta variant has raised concerns with 125 new cases reported on Tuesday. Grim new developments out of Europe, where more countries are registering record numbers of COVID deaths. That has raised fears that the continent may be back at the epicenter of the pandemic. Ukraine has lost a record figure of more than 830 people to the pandemic in the past 24 hours. That has raised the total deaths to more than 73,000. Also nearly 19,000 new infections in the same period. And in Bulgaria, the daily fatalities have hit a record high of over 330 on Tuesday. Its new cases have passed 5,000. Bulgaria is Europe's least vaccinated country. Just a day earlier, Germany, Russia, and Greece had near record levels of infections. Europe is reporting more than half of all new cases worldwide. In the UK, border forces are refusing to implement new plans that target the migrants, fearing that they would lead to more deaths at sea. While the COVID-19 pandemic significantly reduced the flows of immigration to Europe in 2020, the numbers and the deaths are once again souring these days. Bianca Rahimi tells us more from London.
Overcrowded boat heading towards Europe via Turkey capsized on Saturday. Some of the dead are Palestinians fleeing the Israeli siege on the Gaza Strip. The exact number of deaths is yet to be reported. Europe is divided over how to deal with the mounting humanitarian crisis on its borders. Some are calling for walls and barbed wire. Asylum seekers are being used as pawns in political disputes, and desperate people mercilessly pushed back and forth between borders, left to die in the space between with no food or shelter. The UN has called foul, but it seems no one is listening.
Yet the European Union's 28 members seem to be absolutely abysmally hopeless in organizing any kind of real strategy around migrants and their facilitation. And given, of course, that NATO and Europe is at the heart of causing a lot of the kind of migrancy that is a result of conflicts, you'd have thought that they would have had a little bit more in terms of their human rights and their sort of own, moral conscience to do a lot better.
States around Europe's periphery are the first destinations for asylum seekers coming via sea. Greece, Italy and Turkey have been accused of violent pushbacks, and the UK is entertaining the idea of giving border forces immunity from prosecution if migrants die at sea.
All part of this neoliberal, neoconservative, imperialistic worldview, which much of the establishment in Europe has adopted for many, many years now. And it is fundamentally a barbaric, uncivilized, set of policies which show no signs of abating, and backed by that fear that they created within their public on the grassroots level, there's no real pressure on them from the public to refrain from continuing with their witch hunts and their targeting and their scapegoating of immigrants.
However, the UK's border force is refusing to implement the Home Secretary's plan for fear it will lead to more deaths at sea. Priti Patel is trying to introduce a clause to the Nationality and Borders Bill that will see those arriving via irregular routes receive a prison sentence of up to 4 years. But human rights organisers say Europe's compassion for survivors of war is abysmally low, considering the part they play in conflicts around the world. Countries like France, Italy and the UK have blood on their hands, continuing to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the likes of Israel, the last apartheid on earth, and Saudi Arabia, which has been ravaging Yemen for the last 7 years, pushing it to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's message, which he had issued to the seminaries and ulema in the last month of his life. We discussed the Imam's views on the struggles of ulema and their sacrifices in the way of God to awaken people and to confront oppression on the one hand and sanctimony on the other. The Imam has pointed out that the true ulema have always been supportive of the downtrodden and the oppressed strata against tyrannical and puppet rulers. We also discussed Imam Khomeini's warning in his testimony to the seminaries and great ulema against deviation. Stay tuned to follow the discussion. One of the important axes that have been stressed in Imam Khomeini's testimony is the necessity of new organization in the structure of seminaries. The Imam, as a pioneer in this field, believed that if the seminaries did not embark on reform and development under the supervision of the sources of emulation and great ulema, others would step in for the purpose with wicked goals. This had been experienced during the rule of illiterate and ruthless Reza Khan, whose real aim was to obliterate ulema and Islam in Iran. Therefore, during the era of Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Hossein Borujerdi, Imam Khomeini strove to reform the seminaries, especially that of Qom. But he faced obstructionism of opportunities and dogmatic elements who had infiltrated the ranks of clergymen under the guise of benevolent persons. Imam Khomeini was very concerned about reformation of the structure of seminaries, even when he was in exile. Imam Khomeini's warnings during the tough times in Najaf would arouse committed ulema and young students to reform the seminaries. He made all these efforts alongside his struggles for the Islamic Revolution. He told the students and ulema, "You will be able to remove these corruptions and difficulties and thwart their colonial schemes only through self-expurgation, preparation and proper order. If you do not reform yourselves, do not become equipped and do not make order and discipline rule over your lessons and life, you will be, God forbid, doomed to destruction in the future. Before losing the opportunity and before the enemy gains access to all your religious and scientific affairs, ponder, wake up and rise up. In the first phase, embark on self-expurgation, purification, and reformation. Become equipped and orderly. Set up order and discipline in seminaries. Do not let others come and make seminaries orderly. Do not let the enemies administer the seminaries with the pretext that these people are not qualified. They cannot do anything, and they are a handful of jobless people who have gathered together in seminaries so that they would corrupt the seminaries in the name of order and reform and would subjugate you. Do not give them pretext. If you become orderly and self-expurgated and all your affairs are orderly, others would not have view upon you and would not find way to infiltrate the seminaries and the community of clergymen. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution and foundation of the Islamic Republic in Iran, naturally the necessity of new organization in seminaries was highlighted more than ever. As the grounds were set for this purpose, Imam Khomeini was more sensitive on the issue. He writes in his testimony, "I recommend for all eras, especially the current era, as the schemes and plots have become faster and stronger, that the uprising for organization of seminaries is necessary and essential, so that the ulema and great figures would spend time and, through accurate program, preserve seminaries, especially the Qom Seminary and other great and important seminaries against ills in this juncture in time. Another serious concern of Imam Khomeini with regards to the ulema and seminaries was his high emphasis on safeguarding the traditional jurisprudence known as Fiqh-e Jawahiri or Jawahiri jurisprudence. He writes in his historical message, "As for education and research in seminaries, I believe in the traditional jurisprudence and Jawahiri ijtihad and do not consider as permissible to disregard it. Ijtihad, independent reasoning on the basis of the Quran and Hadith, is correct on the same basis, but it does not mean that the jurisprudence of Islam is not dynamic. Time and place are two determining elements in ijtihad. What used to have an edict in the past, it seems that the same issue may get a new edict in terms of the relations ruling on politics, society, and economy of system. A jurisprudent should smartly and sharply guide a great Islamic and even non-Islamic society, and beside sincerity, God-wariness, and asceticism, which are worth a jurisprudent, should be really a prudent manager." Imam Khomeini points to this issue in his testimony too. "It is necessary that the respectable ulema and teachers not allow lessons that are related to jurisprudence and the jurisprudential seminaries of the grand ulema, which are the only way for preservation of the Islamic jurisprudence, to become deviated and try to increase precision, debate, discussion, and research every day. The traditional jurisprudence, which is the heritage of the righteous predecessors and deviation from it, will weaken the pillars of research and erudition, must be preserved and researches should be increased. Of course, programs will be prepared in other sciences concerning the needs of the country, and Islam and people should be trained in those fields." Dear listeners, next time, we will continue discussing Imam Khomeini's view.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akhwai. When it comes to Iran's sanction-lifting talks with the P4 plus 1 group of countries, Iran has made its stance clear. From sanctions removal to the U.S. assuring and guaranteeing that it won't pull out of the deal again. But the U.S. has not given any assurances on neither, even though talks are set to resume on November 29. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether these talks are doomed to fail and whether it has any chances of success.
Iran's nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action,
has been in the spotlight for quite some time now, after the US, in May 2018, unilaterally withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In recent months, all eyes have been on Iran to see what approach it takes over the JCPOA after the country's new administration, led by President Ebrahim Raisi, came to power in August.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
When the administration of President Joe Biden took office in January, Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. The US and its Western allies exerted pressure on Iran over the past months to resume the talks, but Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran will first review the previous Vienna negotiations and then start talks with Russia, China, the UK, France and Germany, known as the P4 plus 1 group. Just last week, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said Iran and the EU agreed that Tehran and the P4 plus 1 start talks on November 29th. He stressed that the talks should result in the removal of sanctions on Iran. The terminology that the Iranian official has used for the upcoming talks attaches significance to Tehran's approach towards the JCPOA. The term start conveys the message that Iran seeks to begin result-oriented negotiations. Talks with the aim of removing sanctions indicates that the revival of the JCPOA and the US return to the deal is not of substantial importance to Iran. What matters is the removal of all sanctions under various titles in action and not on paper. The US has been trying to push Iran to succumb to its demands via the so-called maximum pressure campaign that was launched by the Trump administration following its unilateral JCPOA pullout. But such a pressure campaign has backfired, since Iran has strengthened its defense capabilities, advanced its nuclear program, and begun to enrich uranium to the 60% level. Now, the ball is in the court of the US and its Western allies. They should decide before November 29th on whether they want to take a lesson from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, which top White House officials have explicitly branded as a failed policy, or go on with their anti-Iran agenda. The new Iranian government believes that national interests will be achieved by increasing the country's power. What is certain for now is that the speed of Iran's enrichment shows that the country will not accept restrictions on its nuclear activities in case of non-compliance by the United States.
Well, I guess joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, journalist, political analyst, and author Daniel Lazard joins us from New York. Also joining us, political analyst and professor of American Studies at the Faculty of World Studies at the University of Tehran, Fuad Azadi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. With Zadi, I'm going to start with you, and perhaps I'm going to set the tempo to this spotlight program from a quote from the head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, who has said, quote, "The U.S. president, lacking authority, is not ready to give guarantees. If the current status quo continues, the result of the negotiations is clear." Tell us what he means by that.
Well, he basically is talking about one of the difficulties that exist in the negotiations that happened in Vienna, the six rounds of negotiations. And the problem was that the Iranian side was saying that if we reach an agreement, how would we know whether the current administration, the Biden administration, or the next administration will actually stay in the agreement? That's a legitimate question, because we had the Trump administration just decided to leave the agreement after Iran had done what Iran needed to do under the agreement. So the Obama administration got all the concessions that they wanted from Iran, and then many of the things that they were supposed to do under the agreement, and then you had the Trump administration that left the agreement altogether. So it's a legitimate question on the Iranian side whether this is going to happen again, because as they say in the United States, if you fool me once, shame on you. If you fool me twice, shame on me. And Iranians are not fooled, so they don't want to face similar situation that they experienced during the Trump administration, given the fact that Biden may not run in 2024, given its difficulties. And Trump is gaining popularity. So he may run again, he may become president, or some other Trump crony like Mike Pompeo may run and get elected. So that's the basic question that Iran has. That if we go back to the agreement, do get rid of all the advances that Iran has made, follow the spirit and the letter of the agreement the way Iran did in 2015 until 2018, how would we know if the other side would do their part, or whether they will just leave the agreement? That's a question that Iran has. The answer that the Biden administration gives is we don't know. We're not giving any guarantees for the next administration. We're not even giving any guarantees for their own administration, citing the U.S. Congress, citing other excuses. So when Mr. Shamkhani talks about U.S. president that doesn't have any authority, that's what he basically is talking about, that the U.S. president cannot do anything to for the other side, for the Iranian side, to believe that they're actually going to follow the agreement.
Sure. Well, Daniel Azar, we're also looking, in one respect, what Dr. Azadi said there about perhaps Trump running and maybe him or somebody else winning, like Pompeo, would lead to maybe the U.S. pulling out of the deal. But we're looking at also at current responses coming, like from Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican who he recently tweeted about this Iran deal, said it is a 100% certainty that any future Republican president will tear it up. So when you have that kind of statement coming, doesn't Iran have a right to then have a question mark when it comes to this deal actually sticking and then wanting a guarantee on it?
Well, I must say the Americans, and I include myself among them, are a bit puzzled by this Iranian response, because it's axiomatic that a new president will have the power. He's not bound by any previous administration. If he wants to abandon a treaty, he's free to do so. If the UN wanted to walk out of, if the U.S. wanted to walk out of the UN tomorrow, it could do so. you know, or, you know, if Trump wants to do it 4 years from now, there's nothing to stop him. But I think the real issue is that I don't think there's any chance that, Biden will re-enter the agreement. Biden is increasingly weak. His poll ratings are plummeting. He's very unpopular. His performance is incompetent in office. I think it's clear, it's increasingly clear the Republicans will regain the White House in 2024. And meantime, Biden just shows no interest in a serious approach to the negotiations in Vienna. He won't do anything to reduce sanctions or much less eliminate them. And the official U.S. position is to make additional demands on Iran, which have nothing to do with a nuclear accord. And the U.S. is insisting that that Iran agree to these demands as a precondition for entering the re-entering the 2015 agreement. So the U.S. position is impossible from the outset. And I have, from the start, I have been completely pessimistic about any chances of a Biden administration re-entering that agreement. I've been saying that since before there was a Biden administration, and when Joe Biden was only a candidate, was still running on the campaign trail. I argued then, and I argue now, that there is simply no chance of the U.S. re-entering that agreement.
Yeah, and that's true. And Fuad El-Zaidi, that is the case when it comes to what our guest has said in terms of him being insistent and very pessimistic about this actually happening. But there's a question mark here, Fuad El-Zaidi. I don't know if you can answer this or not. And that is both sides know, at least Iran knows, I shouldn't say both sides, Iran knows what it needs. Iran knows what it wants. Iran has voiced what it wants. So before the negotiations start, Iran's stance, at least, is very clear. Given the fact that the U.S. knows that, and given the fact that there's going to be talks, does that mean that there's a chance of success? Because if there wasn't, and Iran has relayed its stance, then why would the U.S. want to start negotiations, in direct negotiations, I should say, through the P4 plus one for sanctions lifting?
Well, I don't think the U.S. is interested in negotiating with Iran to lift sanctions. They like sanctions. They have an addiction to sanctions. They are sanctioning over 30 countries as we speak. It's part of the U.S. government foreign policy to sanction people that don't agree with U.S. domination, whether in their own countries or elsewhere. They are negotiating with Iran because they like JCPOA, but they like JCPOA when Iran does what Iran is supposed to do. And they don't like JCPOA when they are supposed to do their part. So they very much speak about JCPOA in terms that are quite strong. They like it, but they like it when Iran implements it. Another reason they are interested in Vienna talks is to create a consensus among P4 plus one countries, the Europeans plus Russia and China, to basically create a united front against Iran. That's the basic idea. The Europeans generally follow U.S. foreign policy, particularly when there is a strong demand from the United States. That's what they have done since World War II. And the hope of the U.S. government is to at least make Russia and China stay quiet and go along with whatever U.S. and Europeans are designing to do. That's the basic idea. And then there's a lot of propaganda involved. So yesterday when Jake Sullivan was talking to the U.S. media, he says that we are ready to go back whenever Iran does. So that basically gives them a talking point. Biden, during his campaign, talked about returning to the nuclear agreement, and he could do so on the first day that he became president, the same day he returned to the Paris Accord. And the reason he hasn't done that is because of what's going on inside the U.S. government and the pressure that the U.S. government is getting from the Israelis and the Saudis and the Israeli lobby and people like that.
Can you please expand for us more about that, what our guest, Arpoud Ouzadi, said, Daniel Azar, about Israel, Israeli lobby, and what they're doing within the U.S. administration?
Yeah, first of all, I agreed with every single word your other guest uttered. He's completely correct. And the U.S. is under intense pressure from Israel and the Saudis. And as we know, I mean, Israel, has huge power in Washington, and it has, the Saudis have economic influence. The Israelis have huge amounts of political and ideological influence, and that is really quite decisive. It's not to say that Biden is a tool of the Israelis 100% of the time, but let's just say he's a tool of the Israelis 95% of the time. And so the Israelis are putting intense pressure on the White House not to re-enter the JCPOA. They're calling all their allies into the fight. And Biden is just extremely unlikely to buck that pressure, especially now that his polls are plummeting. He's increasingly unpopular, and therefore he's very weak.
Ouzadi, we got to look at different aspects of the sanctions lifting talks with the P4+1, and looking at what may happen and how the response should come from the U.S. side when it comes to, for example, the sanctions being lifted. What is it that the other side needs to do, and in particular the U.S.? Thing they need to do, as one analyst has stated, is to offer speedy relief from these sanctions, but also find a mechanism to reassure the rest of the world and financial institutions that it's okay to do business with Iran. Now, my question to you is, when the deal was signed back in 2015, originally, and everything was okay then, the U.S. still went around and said, don't do business with Iran, and it still promoted an air of doubt for anybody, company-wise or country-wise, to do business with Iran. How can they reassure Iran of that this time around if things were to go in a positive direction?
Well, it's not really complicated. If the United States wanted to return to the agreement, they could return to the agreement. They could do it. Biden could do it on the first day of his presidency, could do it today. And by returning to the agreement, it means that they would implement sanctions, relief, sections of the agreement. Because after all, it was the Trump administration that caused all these difficulties by leaving the agreement. And then the Biden administration people who were not in the government at that time criticized Trump for doing so. So if the Biden administration wanted to return to the agreement, they can do it today. But they're not doing that. They're not lifting sanctions. They're actually putting more sanctions on Iran. They used to say that Iran wants to build a nuclear weapon. About 10 days ago, Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, issued a statement sanctioning people in Iran and companies in Iran that are building drones that are, as you know, they're not weapons of mass destruction. So once Iran gave a lot of concessions on its nuclear, peaceful nuclear program, it seems they like that, and now they want concessions on other military equipment in Iran that have nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. So that's the basic problem that Iran has, that no matter what you give the United States, they come back and want more. And this is what Mindy Sherman, who is now Under Secretary of State and during the Obama administration was the lead negotiator on the U.S. side, said a few months ago in the U.S. Congress that 2021 is not 2015. And by that, what she means is that in 2015, they had some concerns, and they got a nuclear agreement, and those concerns went away. Now, in 2021, they want new things from Iran. That's what she basically implies. And you put yourself on the side of the Iranian government, and you realize that last time you signed an agreement with the United States, they didn't do what they were supposed to do, and they left. And this time, they want more concessions without doing the things that they were supposed to do in 2015 and later on. So that's why you see a lot of hesitations in Tehran. They're going to Vienna for talks, but as you mentioned in the tweet of Iran's National Security Council Secretary, that they're not very optimistic about the United States because you know how the U.S. government behaves. And so that's quite clear to them.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We have to end it there. Let me thank our guest, journalist, political analyst, and author, Daniel Lazar from New York. A pleasure for your contribution there. And Dr. Fouad Azadi, thank you so much, political analyst and professor of American Studies at the Faculty of World Studies at the University of Tehran. Thank you so much. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From the Covered Halfway and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining me in the studio is our dear friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Dear Sayyid, in Islam we have a concept of enjoining good and forbidding evil. So our question is as follows. Why do we, first of all, even have this concept? And this concept, was it present in the time of the Imam Ali alayhi salam when he was the caliph? And in addition to that, did he also forbid evil and enjoin good the same way that we do now as he did in the time of the caliphate of the Imam, peace be upon him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, call for good and forbid from evil, which is Amar bil Ma'ruf and Nahy anil Munkar. This is from the branches of the religion. And this is something which is also referred in the Quran. We have many verses that talks about amal bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, that call for good and stop or forbid from evil. And this is something which cannot be forgotten in any time. Even at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, there was the call for good and forbidding from evil, and it was in its own ways. Now, the main issue is when we talk about such an issue or such a topic,
right,
we assume generally, like the public, they assume that this means that someone goes onto the pulpit and
right,
he starts speaking, or maybe going into the streets, stopping people from what they're doing, like if they're performing any bad deeds. So
right,
you stop them, you forbid them, and then you call them towards the mosque. I don't know, there are the charities or the good things. This is what the concept, basically. It's generally
right
in the minds of the people.
Reminding people to do good and
yeah,
stop evil.
Whereas reminding people for the good and stopping from the evil has a broader meaning. It can be with the actions, with our, the actions that we perform, our own character can even
right
show that. Maybe a speech can do that. Maybe when teacher is teaching
right
the kids at the school, he or she is doing that. Parents, when they're talking to their kids, they're doing that. So, but altogether, obviously, we need to see that in the society itself, there should be amar bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar in order to have a good society.
Right.
Because the basic idea or the goal of Islam and the Islamic lifestyle is to take people towards the perfection. Now, anything that stops people from getting into the perfection, obviously, we need to alarm people. We need to obviously acknowledge people that if there is something that will take them faster in order to get to the perfection, they should do that, which is called for good. And if there is something which stops them from reaching to the perfection, which is evil, obviously we need to forbid them. There is a very beautiful definition by the Prophet ﷺ about the amar bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, call for good and forbid from evil. And once someone asked him, what does it mean? Does this mean to interrupt into the people's personal life?
Right.
You know, everyone has their own choice.
Right.
So this is another idea. In the secular states, they say, like, you should not interrupt people. You cannot disturb others.
Right.
They're
people
doing
are
their
free,
own thing.
They have
yes
liberties. Right.
Yes. This freedom has a meaning, obviously. It has its boundaries, basically.
Right.
Now, the Prophet, when it was asked, Prophet just gave an example. And he said, imagine there are 5-6 people who are traveling on a boat, and obviously they're traveling on the water, like using
right
a boat. Now, in the middle of water, when they reach to the middle of river or sea, if one of them who bought the ticket for that ship or boat, if he stands up and picks up a hammer and start digging the place where he was, or start digging his seat or the place where he was sitting, and if you ask him, like, why you're doing so, and if he replies to you that I'm doing at my area, this is my area,
right,
yeah, it has nothing to do with you,
it's
you're sitting at your own
space.
Yes, it's not your space, it's my personal
right
space, so I can do whatever I want because I've bought this place and this belongs to me. It has nothing to do with you. You guys are, I'm not
right
touching you, I'm not obviously harming you, I'm not making a hole at your place. It's my own place, so I can do whatever I want. The question is, the Prophet said, the question is, will the rest allow him to do, continue to do
to
such an action or not?
Digging a hole in the
yeah
boat.
Digging a hole in the boat means, making a hole in the boat means that the water will come and everyone will sink.
Right.
The whole boat. Similarly, the Prophet said, if there is an action which is making a hole for the society, which harms the society, which results